Welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Brandon Buddha.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. On this episode, we are talking about Confessions of a Mask, 1607 by Alan Moore. This is chapter 7 of the novel Voice of the Fire, which tells the story of Northampton, England over the course of 6,000 years as a series of loosely connected novellas and short stories. And Voice of the Fire was originally published in 1996.
This episode comes to you by way of one of our Patreon supporters, so it's a bonus episode, and you know, we've had some ups and downs reading this book. I loved this story, I can say that, and so thank you. I mean, I think it's been worth it for me to go through some of the difficulty of the early stories to get to this one, which I just found to be spooky and fun and strange and just a lot of winking to historical events that I actually knew a little bit about this time. So this one worked for me.
Yes, let me also say thank you to the supporter who commissioned this episode and has been having us read through this entire book. I should also, before we get into it, I should also take an opportunity just to remind Alan Moore fans that we do have an entire bonus series on Alan Moore's Swamp Thing run that is available on Patreon. So if you're interested in that and you're not already with us on Patreon, you can join us and check that out. But yeah, let's get into the story. And as you have suggested here, Brandon, with Confessions of a Mask, we are now entering the modern period of history. So this is really a period where more of the events that Moore is going to be writing about are going to be elements of our pop culture. Though I will say Moore has picked one of the foundations of our modern pop culture here. Last time I had predicted that we were going to get something Shakespearean for 1607, since this is the height of Shakespeare's career. But no, instead, we're in for something that is really completely different. So let's not take any longer to actually get to it. And Brandon, you can take us away now.
Well, as you said, Glenn, it is 1607. It's roughly 500 years since last we checked in with Northampton. You'll recall in the last story that the construction of the Round Church was underway. That's been completed, as we see in the story. But before we get into the plot, again, I want to do two things. The first thing is just to say that the narrative of this story or the events of this story are told to us in the first person. And that first person narrator gets told a tale by a second person. All of this will make sense as we go on, but primarily what we're dealing with is the ruminations of a man who is connected to a pretty well-known historical event, and then his conversation with a man connected to maybe a kind of trivial historical event that took place in 1607. What I'm saying is we're going to be looking at two historical events in the early decade of the 1600s. The second thing I want to do is read the opening paragraph, because Moore really shifts his style here in terms of prose. Maybe it's just more accessible than the past stories have been, but I really loved this opening paragraph, and it really is pretty important in setting up the premise of the tale as well. So here's how Confessions of a Mask, AD 1607, begins. It disappoints me to recount that lately I have found myself again afflicted with identity, and so beset by a great pestilence of thoughts, arid, inconsequential things. They rattle uselessly within the parchment seed pod of this smirking mask I am become. Worse, they provoke a fearful itching at the rear interior of my cranium, where I fear yet clings some withered clot of mind, gray husk of brittle sponge wrung dry, crusted upon the inner shell like relic snots discovered on the pages of old books. So what's going on here, what is suggested by the opening paragraphs, is that we as the audience are privy to the interior thoughts of a skull rotting on a wall that has been skewered with a pike. The skull has, not the wall. And the skull's thoughts stray to wondering what time of year it is and whether his father is still alive, and thinking about the skull's father's building of a triangular hunting lodge called Rushton Hall. Now, the triangular nature of the hall is important because it's meant to honor the Trinity. It's the father's, building that honors a pretty important part of church doctrine. And so through this and some other clues, we are given to learn that the skull on this pike is Francis Tresham, son of Thomas Tresham, who owned lots of land in Northampton and who also built Rushton Hall.
Right. This is a weird story. I mean, of course it is, right? That's what we do here is weird stories. But what I mean is, this is a strange story in this collection of weird tales, because thus far, we haven't had anything quite so supernatural as this. And we'll definitely take that up in the discussion. But yeah, we are inside the mind of a dead person, a decapitated dead person at that, or actually, I guess not decapitated, because that means a body without a head. But I don't know, what is the term for a head without a body? Debodied, I guess. Decorpsed, we'll say, I guess. But anyway, before we get too far into this, I should get us situated in time just a bit. I'll do more in the discussion, of course. But yeah, we're in 1607, and this is a fair distance from our previous story, as you've said, Brandon. We are deep into the Reformation at this point. And that's a big tent term that we use to mean the breakup of the Christian church in Western Europe that happened at the end of the Middle Ages, also the theological debates, the military violence, and the founding of many, many, many new Christian churches that came about as a result of that. But we are also deep in Shakespeare time, and we are right after the defeat of the Spanish Armada. And this is also set the very same year that the Jamestown colony in Virginia was founded. So, you know, if any of those things conjure up some kind of image for you from some other pop culture thing, then you've got it. You've got a sense of when we are. I should also say here, Brandon, as well, that Rushton Hall is indeed a place that is associated with the Tresham family, but it is not the triangular building that Francis Tresham's head is thinking about. Rushton Hall is actually the house that Francis and also his father Thomas would have lived in as aristocrats, as barons here. Though they also, I should be clear, they would have had a house in London, but this would have been the seat of their family estate and their family title. But the hall, Rushton Hall, was really actually built significantly before this story. It was built in the first half of the 16th century, so probably built by Francis's grandfather, possibly even a generation or two earlier. We don't have precise dates for it. What's awesome, though, is that this building is still there today, and it's a hotel. So whenever we have enough Patreon supporters to put on our own con, obviously, this is where we're going to do it. We're going to do that in Rushton Hall. I should say, though, that about half of the building was constructed after this story takes place. But still, it's gorgeous. It has to be haunted. Maybe not by Francis Tresham, but, you know, it's got to be haunted by somebody. So hopefully we'll be able to have a con there someday. That's my new dream, at any rate. But the building that Francis is thinking about is on the grounds of Rushton Hall, and it's just called the Triangular Lodge. I mean, it just is what it says on the box, right? It's a small building. It's super weird. I mean, it is triangular. And in fact, the whole building is just designed around the number three. There are three floors, three sides. There's three windows in each side. Of course, as you said, Brandon, the number three corresponding to the Christian Trinity. But it is also a play on the name Tresham. The family crest used a trefoil, a three-pointed hat. The building is also just covered in Latin inscriptions. I mean, they're from scripture. There's also Catholic religious iconography, but it's also covered with numbers. And what those numbers mean is an occasional topic of art historical debate. Moore has actually taken a side in this debate here by having Francis think about the numbers as having to do with the age of the earth, according to interpretations of the book of Genesis. And here's what Moore writes. "My father's calculations hinged upon a calendar suggested by a certain bishop, I do not recall his name, who had established to his personal satisfaction the specific date on which the world commenced." And this is cool. This is awesome, right? But I don't know who this bishop is. I have no idea who this bishop is. If you ask someone to name a bishop from this period who was into this question, the answer is James Usher, who was a Protestant, not a Catholic, and in fact was in charge actually of the whole Protestant church in Ireland. But Usher didn't publish his book on this subject until 1650, and he was only a teenager when the lodge was constructed, so it couldn't have been him. And that's awesome for me, because I love not knowing. I love also not being able to figure it out. And if anyone knows who Moore has in mind here, I would love to know.
Moore takes lots of, I think, sides in historical debates in this story. Questions of, as we'll see, you know, who wrote a secret letter that revealed the gunpowder plot, as we'll get into in a moment. There's a lot going on in this story that, again, Moore is playing a little bit fast and loose with history, but he's introducing his readers into the deep local history of Northampton. And that's what I really, really love about this story. And it's great, you know, when you get that charge of familiarity with one of the stories, as I did here. So yeah, this is a really fun way to bring readers who are unfamiliar with even maybe British history at large to the history of a place in a specific time. Local history, I love it. And you're right, we should do a con in England, though I don't know if we need to go to Rushton Hall, because I'd rather do one in Oxford and meet up with fans of the series Endeavor or Inspector Morse or Lewis. I feel like I need to go to that town before I die.
Yeah, well, we'll make a whole trip out of it. Of course, this is a fantastical thing that's not actually going to happen. This is less likely to happen than hearing from the ghost of a decorpsified head on a pike.
Well, let's return to that decorpsified head. Let's return to Francis, or the ghostly presence trapped inside Francis's rotting skull. So we get to a point in the story here where Francis tells us about his day. He goes through what the wall guards are up to in classic, you know, Moorean fashion, what they're like and so forth. A lot of jokes about the body. Francis lets us know that lots of couples like to fool around within his sight, and that kids throw stones at him. And one of these stones, which was actually a lump of coal, has gotten lodged into his eye socket. Francis, you know, he's got nothing to do but think, so his thoughts bounce around a lot. He remembers his friends Catesby and Fox and Winter. So, you know, this is the point where if you're even remotely familiar with Moore's other work, namely V for Vendetta or British History, the name of Fox is going to jump out to you here, as it's meant to. We also learn, in terms of historical orientation, that James I is King of England and has recently, within the past few years, begun his rule of England. Previously, you know, James had ruled in Scotland, but whatever, that's not what's on Tresham's mind here. Tresham is just thinking about how he has no love for King James. That's because Tresham's father was Catholic, and this caused some trouble for the Tresham family, as James I of England was a Protestant king. Now, before the story breaks, and I'll break there for a moment as well, I do want to point out that Moore adds some connective tissue between this chapter and the past chapters in the novel by way of giving Francis some dreams about, like, you know, torso gardens and ambulatory legs. So the spirits are active in Northampton.
Yeah, I don't have enough dreams about torso gardens. Actually, I have the right amount of dreams about torso gardens, yeah, which is
zero.
It's zero. That's right. Yeah, I'll talk more about why being Catholic would cause some trouble for the Tresham family in the discussion. But we should definitely pause here to talk about why these names, Fox, Catesby, and Winter, are important. And everyone has heard of Guy Fawkes, right? Even Americans. That is, as you're suggesting, Brandon, I think largely thanks to Alan Moore himself. But these people were the perpetrators of the gunpowder plot of 1605. The gunpowder plot was an attempt by this small group of disaffected English Catholics, attempt to kill the Protestant King James. And the plan was to do this by blowing up the Parliament building while the king was there. I mean, it's basically the exact plot of Designated Survivor and any other number of thriller movies about blowing up the Capitol building during the State of the Union or something like that. Anyway, they did not succeed, and that's how Francis Tresham died. And of course, this episode, this event, this has survived into contemporary culture as Guy Fawkes Night. Guy Fawkes was the one who was overseeing the use of the explosive. So even though he wasn't really the ringleader here, he's held up as being the principal villain of this episode. And of course, this is really called Bonfire Night, and you build a big bonfire. Also, maybe you burn an effigy of Guy Fawkes, though I think people do that way less often now than they did a century ago. And of course, it's really the bonfire part of this that is going to matter, as we will see.
That's right. Well, let's return to the narrative here. We're at the point of the story now where a second skull joins Francis on the wall. I suggested this was going to take place at the beginning of the recap. The man whose head is being placed next to Francis's on the wall, his name is Captain Pouch, though we'll learn shortly that his name is actually John Reynolds. Now, he's a blustery fellow, and he's outraged at the treatment he's received and the torture and hanging and quartering that has led to his death. But it's through Pouch's arrival here, or Pouch's head, that Francis learns the actual date, which is of interest to him because he's been thinking about how much time has passed since he's been perched on the wall himself. So Francis learns that it's either late October or very early November in 1607. I mean, we're going to learn that it's actually early November because Francis can hear the chanting of "Remember, remember" by people and kids doing, you know, the kind of fire ceremony nearby, the bonfire night. In any event, we get some of Pouch's story now. As I said, his name is John Reynolds, and Reynolds, or Pouch, tells Francis that he's been executed because he took up a fight against tyranny in England. And the tyranny he fought in specific was against the family named Tresham, a family of, quote, skulking thieves that had, with their ill-gotten wealth, seized land so that the good folk thereabout were left with only scrub on which to grow their food, end quote. And not only was there no good land left upon which to grow food, but a giant dovecote, a building that is just very outre, has also been built on this ground as well. Now, this family, the Treshams, had also built a large church on the grounds, and so Pouch is just full of this sense of injustice, of these people who hoarded all this land and left their townies, their villains, to starve. You know, should a church be built where people who are going hungry could grow food there? This is a very kind of New Testament sort of question, I think. Anyway, Pouch goes on to tell Francis Tresham that he'd gathered 1,000 followers by, quote, telling them that what he carried in the pouch about his neck would be sufficient to repel all enemies. That's the end of the quote there. And so Pouch led a revolt against the Treshams with his followers, which failed, and then he was executed.
Yeah, I'm going to spoil a bit of the story here by saying that what's in the pouch is not the mummified head of Christ, though you could be forgiven for thinking that that's the through line that Moore is going to take here, but it is not. We will find out what it is later. At any rate, as you indicated earlier, Brandon, this is another real event. This is the Midlands Revolt, and this went on for about 2 months in the spring of 1607. It was a popular uprising against a rather insidious idea of modernity, which is the idea that all land everywhere must be owned by someone. During the Middle Ages, a lot of land in England was just called the Commons. And what that meant was that anyone could use it for just about anything. And this land, the Commons, this was an important part of agricultural life. But in early modernity, the English aristocracy decided that any land not owned by someone else was obviously owned by them, and that farmers using that land ought to start paying rent. And so they put up enclosures around the commons, and Captain Pouch here led a popular uprising that was meant to be nonviolent. He did enlist the help of really thousands of people to tear down these enclosures. But then the king gave the local gentry permission to end the riots by any means necessary. And so what those means were was private armies breaking up the riots. And about 50 people here were hanged at the end of this. That includes, obviously, here, Captain Pouch. I should also clarify as well that the Treshams that Captain Pouch was rising up against weren't actually Francis's immediate family. It wasn't Francis's father or his siblings. These were cousins. But in thinking about that, Francis remembers going to the estate of these cousins to attend church, this new church that they've erected there, and remembers his father telling him every time they took this journey, telling him the story of a ghost that would ride with people traveling that road. It's the road that goes over Barford Bridge. And this is a real Northamptonshire urban legend. It dates at least from early modernity. I can't find any instances of it, any accounts of it from the Middle Ages, but it seems to have something to do with the nearby Cistercian Abbey, which of course was broken up during the Reformation. And so even just this ghost story here, this is totally on motif for this, this tale. But this is something that even today people claim to see. Like, you look in your rearview mirror and you see that there's a monk in your backseat, and then you blink and he's gone. And this is awesome, because I speculated back when we had our Birdman that Moore was doing this sort of thing, but I couldn't find any kind of version of that story in any of the books that I had about Northamptonshire folklore or by any amount of Googling. But now here he is doing it in a way that I was in fact able to trace in a handful of different books of folklore and urban legend about Northamptonshire, and even saw some recent articles in local and regional newspapers about, you know, occurrences of this or sightings of this ghost even within the last decade. So super awesome.
Yeah, the only real shame here is that the men of letters from Supernatural never reference taking out this old monk ghost in Northampton. That's that's what I feel is missing from popular culture and this story. No, that's really awesome. I did not know that was a real folktale. And we simply just don't have enough good ghost stories about stretches of road in this country, though. I think we need to start creating some urban legends. We need to create a live blog or something like that keeps track of all of this. And this would have taken place in 1996, I suppose, is when we would have really been able to pull something like this off. I guess we just need more folk tales. That's all I'm saying. Well, let's return to the story at hand here instead of wishing we had better stories to tell about our stretches of road. So we're back on the wall. Pouch has told Francis his tale, and now Pouch wants to know how Francis came to be on the wall. Now, Francis does not want to tell Pouch, for obvious reasons, that he's a Tresham, as, you know, they're going to be neighbors for some time. So Francis just tells Pouch that he cried, "Down with the king," while in a public place. But of course, that's not what really happened. Francis himself was caught up in the gunpowder plot, the plan to assassinate the Protestant King James led, or at least, I don't know, the face of which was Guy Fawkes. Francis claims that, you know, he might have been the secret suggester of the plot, though. One evening, while drinking with his friends at Rushton Lodge, they, you know, heard this suggestion and then they ran with it. They took it too far. And Francis was uncomfortable with that. So he wrote an anonymous letter to his brother-in-law, Lord Monteagle, warning him to avoid Parliament on a specific date and time. And that unraveled the whole plot. So Francis was arrested, and then he lived out the rest of his life, which did not last long after his arrest, in the Tower of London. And then, according to this story, his head was put on a pike. That's pretty much the end of the story, but there is just one bit of business to clear up here, which is the question of what was in the captain's pouch. You know, what relic could cause people to risk their lives to take back land from the wealthy aristocracy? This is what Francis wants to know, as he's curious of questions of faith here in this story. So John Reynolds tells him there's no point keeping it a secret anymore. Reynolds tells Francis that what he's kept in his pouch is a piece of green cheese. And that's it here. The story ends with children burning effigies and singing their songs somewhere in the dark. Francis cannot see through the coal in his eye socket, though he can sense the fires, wishing that he'd been given deliverance through fire from this ghostly existence. Through the suggested light of the fires, shadows and light interplay against Francis's face and give the impression of animation. But of course, Francis is dead.
We're going to have to talk about those fires because I feel like we have seen them before. But before we dig into any of that, I do want to talk for just a few minutes about this period of history and about the Reformation, which of course is really what this story is all about. And let me start by talking about what period we are in. I've used the term early modern at least once in this episode. And in one sense, that's a fairly obvious term, right? It means the early part of modernity. But of course, then we also need to know what modernity is. And for historians, modernity means, more or less, the world after 1500. It's a historical period in which the disparate parts of our planet, also the people who live in those disparate parts, became increasingly connected. And this begins with European voyages of exploration, really in the 15th century. There are other components of modernism as well, but I will stick with that, at least on this episode. Perhaps we'll talk about more of them in future installments of Voice of the Fire. And early modern does indeed mean the early part of modernity, but it is actually a period that we date from 1300 until 1750 or so. You know, these are always or so. They are rough dates here. And more or less, it includes the late Middle Ages and then goes up to the Enlightenment. That's really what we're talking about. Obviously, this is a European dating scheme here and really even just a Western European dating scheme. And the most important thing that happens in Western Europe, or maybe I should say Western Christendom, during this period is the breakup of the medieval church during what we call the Reformation. And the Reformation is actually not at all what it says on the box, which sounds like it should be a type of reform movement. And maybe it did actually start as that, but it quickly became much more than a reform movement. So let's briefly go back to 1517, when a German priest named Martin Luther published some complaints about the church. Now, he was asked to retract and renounce his writings, and, you know, asked by his boss, essentially, to do that, the chain of command. And when he didn't do that, he was excommunicated. But there were a lot of people who shared his concerns about some church practices, even church organization, and some bits of theology as well. And rather quickly, people began forming new religious communities. Though, really, more often than that, it's previously existing religious communities simply doing things differently now, and maybe that is using scripture that's translated into the vernacular. That's just one example of some of the different things that religious communities are now doing. And importantly, another thing that they are doing is ignoring orders to stop doing whatever the new thing is that they're doing. And so what this amounts to is the central authority of the church leadership in Rome was broken. And this just opens the floodgates. And pretty quickly, there are a lot, I mean, just a ton of new types of Christianity being practiced. Also, they all seem to hate each other. And so there's something of a flame war being carried out in religious pamphlets. But then there also were real wars. The period between 1522 and 1648 saw what we usually now just call the Wars of Religion, which in fact are exactly what they say on the box. This is actually a pretty good name for this. They were wars between and among European states over the issue of religion. Now, saying over the issue of religion, of course, is a pretty obvious simplicity. But the point I'm trying to make is simply that this is a period in which people felt passionately about religious doctrine, religious practice, also religious authority. And they felt so passionately about those things that they were often willing to do violence in support of whatever their particular cause was. Obviously, that is in our story today. That's here in Confessions of a Mask. But we can get more specific than this. So let's zoom in on England, which has its own version of the Reformation. I mean, every place in Western Europe has kind of its own special brand or special version of the Reformation. And in England, this was not a popular Reformation. And what I mean by that is that the impetus for breaking away from the church did not come from regular people, though there were many who wanted to do just that. But what's really happening here is that the Reformation in England was driven from the top by the king. This is King Henry VIII, who is famous for having a lot of wives in his quest to have a son, and also killing some of those wives who failed to give him a son. But the deal is, of course, right, that in medieval Christianity, you can't get a divorce. And if you're the king, you have to get your annulment from the Pope. And the Pope said no to Henry. And so because this Reformation thing is happening on the continent, Henry just removed England from the church and then started his own church instead, which had a new pope. And that new pope said, sure, you can get an annulment because I like my job and I want to keep it. And of course, that church is the Anglican Church or the Church of England, what in America is called Episcopalian. I should say, you know, the head of the church doesn't actually use the title pope. It's the Archbishop of Canterbury. And this move, this creation of the Church of England, it's not really complete until early in the reign of Elizabeth I. Elizabeth I was Henry VIII's daughter. She died in 1603. That brought James to the throne. That's the king who was the target of the Gunpowder Plot. And although I've just thrown a lot of information at you, gentle listener, still, we have this question of, how do we go from, hey, we have different prayers that we like and different ideas about communion, to Catholics have to live under house arrest, and then also the alternative position, which is we should blow up the king because he's a Protestant, right? How do we get to that point, right? Now, the answer is very messy, so I'm going to grossly oversimplify things, but what it amounts to is that there was a rebellion by Catholic earls in Northern England. They were defeated, but then Elizabeth I was excommunicated by the Pope. This has no practical effect, of course, but it created some conundrums for English Catholics. And Elizabeth responded to this excommunication by persecuting Catholics. I mean, some priests were even executed, and it did essentially become illegal to be Catholic at this point. I mean, the penalty was a fine. It was a hefty fine that only aristocrats could actually afford. But at any rate, this is the situation when King James comes to the throne, and passions were reignited because of Elizabeth I's death, because Elizabeth had no children. She's, you know, famous as being the virgin queen, but her having no children meant there was no direct heir. And so there was a hope that her successor might actually be a Catholic, because her predecessor had been, that there was had been this period of back and forth between Catholic and Protestant rulers. And there was this hope that, you know, at least among Catholics at any rate, that her successor could possibly at any rate be a Catholic. But instead, they got an even more fervent Protestant, kind of a wacko Protestant. Actually, I think people are aware that King James wrote a witch hunting manual and was generally obsessed with witches and so on. And so anyway, that's the background for this story, or at least maybe an outline of the background, I guess. I think, though, that in contrast to limping to Jerusalem, you don't really need to have a handle on any of the historical context to grok the weird element of what Moore is up to here. You just don't actually need to know any of this in order for this to work as a weird fiction story, I don't think.
I think that's what made this story work so well for me, was that as it stands, as just a strange piece of writing from the perspective of a ghost about this moment in England, you don't need the full background. You get the sense of the conflict. In other words, you get the sense of the conflict between Catholics and Protestants. You get the reference to Guy Fawkes. You get Bonfire Night. All these things that have become kind of commonplace in popular culture. But even if they weren't, the conflicts are well drawn enough that you get a sense of the stakes of the story, which are small. Don't reveal your identity to your neighbor who, you know, led a raid against your family. And then the through line of that family being important enough to risk your own life to reveal an assassination plot that maybe you suggested by accident one drunken evening. And so there's, the stakes are real in the story. They're grounded in the characters, even if the characters are ghosts uncomfortably housed within skulls. So this story kind of works on every level, but knowing the history really lights up the story in a different way, but the story still works without it. You're right. I mean, that's what I'm saying. You're right.
And I did make the comparison just now to limping to Jerusalem, but I think this was also true for November Saints, right? Maybe less true for November Saints, but at any rate, the two previous stories here maybe didn't require, but certainly benefited from quite a bit of decoding, right? A type of historical sleuthing or decoding that for me was a ton of fun. That's what really made those stories probably my two favorite stories in the collection so far, but as we talked about last time, made them not work for you in ways that I think this story really did work for you. And of course, we will carry this conversation on into the future when we get to the entire end of the book. But that's been part of the fun here, is seeing how these stories work differently for, well, even just for the two of us, and also hearing from listeners about how the different stories are working for them based on how much world building Moore is doing versus how much he's requiring us as readers to bring to the story ourselves. So there is something of a lesson, a writing craft lesson here, I think, just in microcosm in Voice of the Fire, that will be a lot of fun to really take stock of when we do our probably series of wrap-up episodes about 3 years from now.
I think so. I mean, I think the takeaway always for me is just what makes the story work within the text itself. And that's been a struggle to find in some of these stories, though each of these stories does work given enough kind of time and thought put into them. And I'm not just saying that like, oh, you have to really sit down and think about these stories, which you do. And I like stories like that. But there's something of a more immediately satisfying element to the story because, again, even though the premise is strange, the characters are grounded in a way that are maybe hard to make sense of in other of these tales.
All right. Well, I want to shift into going through really our checklist here, where we have a lot of questions, a lot of elements, I guess, really, of the first story, in fact, or the early stories that we've been trying to track through time. Usually the first question that I ask here is there any kind of supernatural element to this story? But we don't have to ask that question this time, because this is actually the first story where the supernatural element is obvious, but also necessary, right? Because this story requires us to believe that we are listening to someone's ghost, essentially. And that's a big shift from all of the previous stories.
We've had this sense in the other stories that people don't really die, that their spirits live on. Many of the stories, but most explicitly, I think the end of the last two stories is where kind of this sense of ghostliness or the continuing on of the spirit is explicit. And this is just continuing to pick up on that. Instead of saying people don't really die in Northampton, the dead don't die, this is a story about the dead who are still alive, though limited in their ability to impact the material world, or even saying they have no impact on the material world. So I think, Moore is picking up here on this, or bringing maybe to a close through this explicit communication of the spirit world, this idea that Northampton is full of history, it's full of historical ghosts, and these people who are crucial to the historical moments and movements in Northampton through architecture, through lore, through church reliquaries, through all sorts of things, they're still alive in some sense. And maybe it's just through their being a part of history, but they still live in a certain way. And Moore is really trying to communicate that to us, that history is alive in Northampton.
Up to this point, I have not been clear if, well, and maybe even still at this point, but at any rate, up to this point, I have not been clear if we are meant to believe the characters of these stories when they are perceiving something as supernatural. So when they're perceiving black dogs or perceiving visitations from angels, I've not been clear if I'm supposed to share their point of view on this, or if I'm meant to be skeptical, or even just meant to disbelieve, to think, no, you didn't really see an angel that told you to go back and dig in the church. Something else has happened. In fact, what's happened is that you've got brain damage because you were kicked in the head by a horse when you were a kid. It's been unclear to me, you know, which of those tacks we're supposed to take. I don't know if this explicit supernatural element means then that we're supposed to believe all of the other supernatural things earlier in the book. What's your feeling about that?
I think it all comes through this sort of dream world, as we've seen, or these moments that bring our characters near to death or death itself, that even these brief codas at the end of the stories, which are often include the character's death, mean that someone is telling the story in their voice or from their point of view. And more, I suppose, is telling us it's them. In other words, my sense is that this is not a collection. This novel is not a collection of textual artifacts, but rather it is not written down. It's the immediate thoughts of people in their moments or the stories that lead up to the moment of their death. And their death is caused either by their own, you know, hubris or their own fatal flaws. These are kind of all mini tragedies in some sense, though this story is comedic because it's told from the point of view of a ghost. And so we're getting the sense that this isn't a collection of tragic moments, but a presentation of the spirit's life, I guess, after they die. And so I do think it is real. I think to encounter this as we're encountering it as a text is what we have to do because we're reading it from a book. But I think Moore is trying to move us beyond that relationship from the text and the reader and giving us the real internal thoughts of these people, these historical people as they lived.
Right. This is not a Gene Wolfe novel, right? Where Gene Wolfe, at least so far in our coverage of the Gene Wolfe Literary Podcast, when he's writing a first-person story, there is a materiality to that story. There's some, it is a record that is actually being crafted in a material sense in the world. It is an object, and we have to consider what that means. Here, we do not. Though I will jump way, way, way ahead in the predictions for future stories segment here and say, I kind of anticipate, though, that when we get to the story that's set in the 1990s, that that story is going to be the written down experience of Alan Moore as the actual narrator of that story. Just a guess, just a hypothesis I have, a little bit of breaking of the fourth wall there that I'm excited to see if we get or not. But before we get to actually making predictions for even just the next story, let's keep checking in here on these elements that we've been tracking. I didn't see any explicit use of the word hob here. I didn't see any orcs. I didn't see any black dogs. Did you see any of those things?
I did not, though the fire rituals are still a huge important part of these people's lives in this town. And I think that that is something that Moore is really, I mean, the novel's called Voices of the Fire. So this is really about tracking these fire rituals and how they change, but maybe they speak to a certain kind of core spiritual reality that kind of predates history to some degree.
Yes, right. I mean, the fire motif is central in this story, right? This is how we get Bonfire Night or Guy Fawkes Night. I should say that Moore here is jumping into another type of scholarly debate. This is a pretty minor debate, but it's a debate about the origins of Bonfire Night. And what Moore is doing here is connecting these November fires, these early November fires, to the Samhain fires that we actually had in the previous story, Limping to Jerusalem. And this is not a novel claim that Moore is making here. This is something that other scholars have claimed. They've claimed that Bonfire Night really is the Protestant appropriation of this pagan festival. It's a pagan festival that had survived during the Middle Ages, but that's it's really just an appropriation here. This is something that James Frazer, who wrote The Golden Bough, he claimed this. He's a great example of this, really probably the only one that I've actually read. But there are a lot of scholars, very recent scholars or pseudo-scholars, really more journalists, I suppose, who make this claim. I don't know of any actual religious or cultural historian who would support this claim now, but in the 19th century, this was the sort of thing that that people would have definitely believed. I don't know if Moore actually believes it or if he just thinks it would be cool if it were true, and certainly has put it in the story here, right? And as you're suggesting, what we're really getting here, I think anyway, is that Moore is saying this all goes back to the hob burning. This all goes back to this first burning that we had in the very first story. That's the origin of Samhain. That's the origin of all of these November bonfire rituals that's been lost in time.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating the way that Moore is tracking this and tying it to a kind of deeper spiritual truth. I mean, we know more kind of biographically, and he's going to show up in this book, so I don't feel bad jumping down this road. Has this sense of being a magician or a wizard, this sense of natural magic in the world. And I think part of what he's doing is tracking the development of that magic in his hometown of Northampton. And it's something he takes very seriously as maybe a point of faith or reality in his own life.
Yeah, and I should say as well that Alan Moore very definitely has read The Golden Bough by James Frazer, which is this book of, well, it's an anthropology book. It's an anthropology study, but this is back when everyone practicing anthropology was what today we would probably characterize as an amateur anthropologist rather than a real professional anthropologist. And it's really a book about ancient magic and how that intersects with different religious rituals. And I think that we have already actually seen some of the fingerprints of that on this book. I think we're going to see more. We might even get more of that actually in the very next story. And I guess last time, or, you know, at least when we did Limping to Jerusalem, which wasn't really the last episode, but the last episode in this series, at any rate, I had said that one of the things that we might end up doing next year is looking at works of pseudo-scholarship. The Golden Bough, I don't think we would put on that ballot because the Golden Bough is actually absurdly long. I mean, like thousands of pages long, but we might do that as a bonus if we wound up doing that series. And really what I mean is Brent and I think would maybe do a bonus on that, because back in high school, in the 1990s, maybe actually right around the time that Alan Moore was writing this book, to be honest, Brent was walking around high school, handing out photocopies of one of the chapters of The Golden Bough to people because he thought it was the most mind-blowing, worldview-shattering thing he had ever read, and he wanted to spread the good word. I mean, it was a real Reformation act. He basically made his own pamphlets and started handing them out in high school.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to hear you guys cover that and talk about that. That would be great fun. Yeah, you can always do sections of some of the longer books out there and just see what's relevant if this were to win our ballot and what we're going to do next year.
All right, well, let's move in now to talking about what we're going to do next in this series. The next story is called Angel Language, and it's going to take place in the year 1618. So, Brandon, what do you think that story is going to be about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to degree, you know, Pentecostalism is a big deal in the early 17th century in England, but that would be my prediction if this were a story taking place during the Great Awakening in America in the 19th century.
So
your question, once again, I would say I have no answer and I can make no predictions. It's a time period I think I'm not familiar with, but this story surprised me. So I can't wait to actually see what 1618 holds, what nuggets of historical trivia I have locked away in my brain that Moore will unlock and I'll discover were there all along.
Yeah, you have grasped onto angel language in this Pentecostal sense as the like speaking in tongues, the receiving these messages from God. But actually, this is really a context that I'm certain that you have heard of, because angel language is actually a pretty important feature of early modern angelology. And angel language is also called Enochian. And specifically, this shows up in the work of John Dee, who was an important figure in Elizabethan England. But he actually died around 1608. So I don't think that he will figure in a story that is set 10 years later. And also all of the work that he was doing on this was really actually from like the 1580s and the 1590s at any rate. So really predates the story that we have just read. On the other hand, we have had an angelic visitation in this book already. I should say Moore imbued that as well with some real creepiness. That actually was something that really disturbed me about the story November Saints. And so I don't know if this is what we'll get, but I'm hoping for another visitation this time, maybe one with some actual angel language. And possibly we will even see here in this next story that this angelic visitation from November Saints is actually a pretty important motif or element of these stories going forward. Of course, we've never been right about anything that we've predicted, so that's almost certainly wrong as well. But that's what I'm hoping for at this point.
I'm genuinely looking forward to figuring out what angel language refers to, especially if we're caught up in some of the British occult magic stuff that was taking place with John Dee and Giordano Bruno, and, you know, though he was Italian. But yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff that Moore could be getting into that I'm looking forward to uncovering.
Yeah, all of those guys were talking with each other. And yeah, occultism in the 16th century, the 17th century was a huge deal. This is actually something that is a big part of the Reformation. This is a big part of really a revival, I guess, in, well, maybe we might even say a religious awakening. I don't think people really refer to the Reformation that way. But religion really, really mattered to people in the 16th and 17th centuries. And that included occultism. And I think the title indicates that we're going to get something like that. So I'm excited for that whenever we get around to doing that episode. But yeah, since we're looking ahead, I think that is going to do it for this one. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buda. You can find us and all our other shows at claytemplemedia.com. If you haven't had the opportunity to yet or taken the time to do it, we'd really love if you reviewed us wherever you get your podcasts, though Apple Podcasts is usually best. That's kind of the central hub of reviews. So if you do that, that would be a huge boon for us at the network.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who takes the time to do that. It really is a huge boon. And of course, we do plan whenever we get to 100 reviews on Apple Podcasts, we do plan to do a bonus series here on the main show on the Call of Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft. So thanks to everyone who writes reviews. It's a big help to us, and it will give us the opportunity to go read and cover one of the foundational stories in what we do here on Elder Sign. Before we go, let me also say thank you to the Patreon supporter who commissioned this episode. I really love this story. This was just an absolute blast. So thank you for continuing to have us read the stories in this book. I also want to remind people before we go that if you're an Alan Moore fan, we do have our Swamp Thing bonus series available on Patreon as well. You can find that on patreon.com/claytemplemedia. And until next time, we greet you and say farewell.